sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, you'll hear the second and final part of an interview with economist Jack Rasmus about how the wealthy are transferring money from the rest of us into their pockets through government monetary policy. Joining me for this discussion is Dr. Jack Rasmus. Dr. Jack Rasmus is the author of several books on the USA and global economy. He has a new one coming out called Hamilton, and he hosts the weekly New York radio show Alternative Vision on the Progressive Radio Network. He also was the shadow Federal Reserve Bank chair of the Green Shadow Cabinet and economic advisor to the USA Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein. He has a PhD in political economy and teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. And to learn more about him, he's got quite a bio. You can go to his website, jackrasmus.com. And Rasmus is R-A-S-M-U-S. We begin here today with Jack Rasmus discussing the role of the central banks. And here he is.
Now, the Fed and central banks say, oh, their mission is not to subsidize the financial markets. Well, that's nonsense. It's always to subsidize the financial markets.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't want you to think that way, you see. So it's the banks that bailed out. The Federal Reserve, the central bank, bailed out the private banks in 2009. Not the government, the banks. Now, the government helped them by suspending what's called mark-to-market accounting. In other words, mark-to-market accounting required banks to report their true losses. Well, Congress passed a rule that says, okay, bankers, you don't have to do that. You can lie. You know? At the same time, the Fed was pushing all this money into the banks for free. The government was saying, okay, bankers, you can lie about how bad your balance sheet really is. Well, why did Congress do that? So that people thought the banks were recovering and they would buy the bank stock, and that would also help the banks recover.
I see.
So they're working hand in hand. The Congress and the central bank work hand in hand, Congress, administration, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing was to bail out the banks, which they did. The banks were totally bailed out in the U.S. in about 1 year, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And corporate profits shot up by 2010, 2011.
So
they were bailed out right away. Why did the Fed then continue zero rates and QE for another 5-6 years? They were bailed out. Well, the reason was they were subsidizing them even more. The banks got addicted to free money.
Mm-hmm.
It was so profitable, and they would not allow the government or their political lead in the government to change that policy.
Yeah, so is it like we have almost like two systems? We have the system with the elite and the banking system and the big corporations, and then we have the rest of us living on a normal budget and means and not getting much help. And it's almost like we have this corporate welfare going on to all the big banks and corporations.
Yes. And, you can trace that also back to the fact that the banks and the big capitalists control government and government policy like they never have since the 1920s. Why is that? Well, that's because of Citizens United, and, you can throw as much money if you're rich at whatever candidate you want, and once you get your candidate in there, you put your lobbyist on their front door, and they make sure they deliver.
Right.
Before neoliberalism in the 1970s, there was like 1,500 lobbyists in Washington. There's over 30,000 lobbyists now, and those are the registered lobbyists.
Amazing.
Running around Washington.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have a lobby, and I'm sure you don't,
but you
know who has a lobby.
That's why no one's doing anything up there for us. They're doing it all.
That's right. It's a system that is now so corrupt and so run by money that, like you say, there's two Americas here. There's two economies and two Americas, and the people up there, and I'm talking about Democrats as well as Republicans, Republican almost to a person is responsible. To the Democrats, you got a few people on the left who are trying to return the Democratic Party to what it once was under FDR. But the corporate wing, the money bag wings of the Democratic Party, the Democratic National Leadership Conference, the leadership does not want to do that.
They've been bought out,
Yeah, that's why they're fighting tooth and nail all these upcomers, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Harris or whatever, you know. They're doing everything they can to prevent them from ever becoming, taking over the Democratic Party again. You know, the Democratic Party changed some of its rules and regulations last summer and pretty much gave the chair of the Democratic Party the right to veto any candidate who they thought did not represent the values of the party. Well, what the
I guess
is that?
That makes it easier than trying to do what they did to Bernie in the primaries. It's a little bit more legal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're never going to let Bernie get that close again.
Right.
And, you know, why Sanders keeps running under the banner is something strange to me, because they've been dumping on him ever since, and they're preparing to dump on him even more.
So let me ask you, Jack, I don't think we fully talked about what negative interest is.
Yes,
I think I interrupted
me.
You.
Yep.
So
okay, I was saying that you have to understand QE to understand negative rates. Now, QE pretty much ran its course between 2009 and 2016. They had injected so much money into the system to bail out and subsidize banks and investors that it was creating financial bubbles. And rates were so low for so long that the central bank decided, well, we got to raise rates now somewhat in case we have another recession, because we won't be able to lower them if we don't raise them, you know, in the interim here before the next recession. Plus, they had to raise them, as I said, to help finance these trillion-dollar deficits from the Trump tax cuts. So QE was stopped in 2016, late 2016. They stopped and they started raising rates. In other words, they stopped injecting money by hundreds and tens of billions every month into the system. It had reached its limits. It was causing more potential instability and preventing the Fed from preparing for the next recession. They needed some ammo of raising rates, right? Well, if QE has reached its end game in 2017, what exists now for the next recession? If Fed rates have only peaked, especially the most important Fed rate is called the federal funds rate. That's overnight loans, very short term. It's peaked at 2.375. They don't have much space to lower rates to try to stimulate the economy if there's another recession. And in fact, over time, since Reagan, we see that every time there's a recession and a crisis, they can't raise rates back up very far again without precipitating another financial crisis. You know, it's 2.37 now. The rate in 2007-8, right before the previous recession, was 5.25. The rate in 2000, before the 2001 recession, was 6.5. The rate in 1990 was 8 before the recession in 91. So you see that the Fed rate after recession is going lower and lower. The Fed has less and less ammunition to deal with a real recession. So, okay, if the Fed rates are so low and QE has run its course, how else are they going to respond in the next recession? That's where negative rates come in, you see. We already have negative rates in Japan and Europe. Negative rates mean, simply, if you're a bank and you want to borrow funds from the central bank, you have to pay the central bank in order to park your funds with them. In other words, usually, you know, when you borrow money from a bank, the bank will pay you interest, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, usually, right? You put your money in the bank will pay you interest, right? Some sort of positive interest.
Right.
Well, now if you put your money in the central bank under negative interest rate policy, you have to pay the bank to put your money in the bank.
So they'll be taking money out of your account to do that.
Yes.
Now, is this just central banks, or will any bank be doing this if it gets...
It could actually get down to the private banks as well. You know, right now, the negative rates in Europe and Japan are quite low. You know, they're less than 1%. The whole idea for negative interest rates is for the central bank to try to force the private banks to loan money to the economy. Right? If you got to pay, if I'm a bank, if I got to pay to put my money in the central bank, well, then I might as well loan it out and get a little bit from somebody in the private sector. It's a way of trying to force the banks to lend, because what's happened is the banks are lending less and less to real people, bank lending and real businesses that create things and jobs. They're lending less and less. Why? Because they're lending more and more to financial markets, which are more profitable. So the lending to the real economy over time is getting lower, lower, lower. And if you have a recession, the lending will kind of freeze up altogether. So negative rates is a way of trying to force the private banks to lend to private sector bankers, you know, non-bank businesses, and to individuals, you know, to buy houses and cars,
right,
and things like that. Right. So that's what negative rates are. Now, there's something that's also called bail-ins, and one of the main functions of the central bank is to bail out banks, as I said. You know, lender of last resort is the same thing as bailing out the banks, the central bank, the Fed, bailing out the banks.
Mm-hmm.
The Fed performed that function by pumping QE and all that money into the private banks. It functioned as a lender of last resort. Now, if QE is not working very well, and if rates are already very low, how are you going to bail out the banks in the next recession? Well, they're already doing pilot programs there in Europe, and both the U.S. and the U.K. have already loaded their gun with what's called bail-ins. They've approved it already. They haven't used it. They're not talking about it. What's a bail-in? Well, a bail-in is if the bank, private bank, gets into trouble, how are they going to be bailed out? Well, bail-in means that whoever has their money deposited in a private bank will have to exchange that real money for bank stock. Of course, the bank stock will be virtually worthless if they have to do bail-ins, mm-hmm, right? Okay. So they could technically take your money and give you stock for your money.
And that would be totally legal for them to do.
Oh, yes. Well, okay. You know, talking about legality, when you give your money to a bank, it's no longer your money, you see. It's the bank's money, legally. It's the bank's money. People don't realize this.
No, I didn't know that. Okay.
Oh, no, you don't know that, but they can do...
So they could refuse to give it back to us if we want.
Well, sure, and when the bank goes bankrupt, you know, you're the last one to get the money.
Ah.
Get your money out.
Yeah.
Right? It's the investors who invested in the bank bonds are first in line, and you depositors are last in line. Well, not actually last. The last are the employees. They don't get paid at all. So bail-ins might be the next big method of bailing out the banks. If QE doesn't work and if interest rates are too low, they're preparing. They're mm-hmm. preparing for the next crisis, and bail-ins might be the solution. They've already done that in Europe with Cyprus and I think Greece to some extent. I'm not sure. But they're prepared to do that again, you see.
Wow.
They'll probably try QE again some more to bail out the banks, and mm-hmm. they'll probably lower interest rates to zero again.
So you had written an article recently about how Trump waxed the middle class, and basically Trump promised he was going to do tax cuts for the middle class. What's happened to that?
Yes, well, you know, I've done some calculations from over the course of the last year. I've produced a couple blog pieces and articles really dissecting the Trump tax cut. You know, the Trump tax cut was really produced by two bankers from Goldman Sachs. I'm talking about Steve Mnuchin, ex-Goldman Sachs, now Treasury Secretary, and Gary Cohn, who was the number one economic advisor to Trump here until the tax cuts were passed. He's since left. He was also a senior CEO or something of Goldman Sachs. So these two guys got together in 2017 behind closed doors and crafted the Trump tax cuts. This wasn't done by Congress. This was done by bankers. And then they dumped it in November of 2017. They dumped it on Congress. And, of course, the Republicans, you know, pretty much owned Congress at the time, both houses. And they rammed it through Congress. There wasn't much debate at all about it. And it's a massive, historic tax cut for corporations, businesses, investors, and the 1%, especially multinational corporations. I estimated, and you can read on my blog, jackrasmus.com, the articles which appeared in Counterpunch and other places. You can read methodology on how I estimated that over a decade, the Trump tax cuts will really deliver $4.5 trillion in tax cuts to corporations, businesses, and so forth, and the wealthiest 1% and investors. $4.5 trillion, not the $1.5 trillion that you hear in the corporate press. No, no. They get that $1.5 trillion simply by assuming that the Trump tax cuts will generate economic activity and therefore more tax revenue to the tune of $1.5 trillion, and then that growth will offset a $3 trillion tax cut. So the hit to the deficit over a decade is only $1.5 trillion. That's a bogus analysis, you see, because it never really identifies how much will these capital incomes actually get in tax reduction. They will get $4.5 trillion. Another $1.5 trillion is involved in a tax hike on the middle class. On the middle class, not the working poor. Mm-hmm. See, they've given some tax cuts to the working poor in raising their standard deduction and a few other things. Massive tax cuts for the top 5%. And then everybody else in the middle is paying more, paying, well, $1.5 trillion.
So again, it's a transfer of our wealth to the wealthy, of the middle classes.
Absolutely. It's a big, as I said before, using the tax system under Trump to accelerate the income inequality, the income transfer from the rest of us, mostly the middle class, to the wealthy and investor class, right?
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. Because they stopped doing that with monetary policy in 2017, you see.
Right.
So then they shift to tax policy. Now tax policy is generating $1 trillion-plus deficits a year. Taxes are responsible for 2/3 of all the deficit. And now they're stopping the tax subsidization, and now with the Fed, they're returning to monetary subsidization. You see, they play both ends of this monetary and fiscal policy to make themselves even richer, and their politicians are just a conduit for enabling all of this and enabling this accelerating income inequality that we see, and the rest of us are left behind. And, you know, those who are left behind rightfully get indignant. And then very cleverly, the Trump in the right wing says, oh, it's all the immigrants that are responsible for this. You know, that's part of the great distraction.
Right.
It's the immigrants that are responsible. Or it's free trade that's responsible, which, of course, it is, just to a large extent. So it's the foreigners. It's, you know, whether it's the coming from Central America trying to get in, or whether it's the foreigners, the Chinese and the Europeans and all the rest. You know, that's the trade policy thing, right?
Right. So none of us are going to look at the manipulations they're doing right before our eyes. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the other wing of corporate party America, called the Democrats, are playing their distraction game. And it's the Russians.
Right.
It's the Russians interfering. So we got this big distraction going on. You know, one side says it's the Russians, other side says it's the foreigners. They're all foreigners, right?
Right.
But no one in the meantime is looking at these politicians who have become the conduit for the transfer of income from the rest of us to the corporations. You know, there's non-corporate businesses. You know, in the article I document how much goes to the multinationals and how much is the corporate tax rate reduction from 37 to 21%. How much is it the 20% pass-through deduction for non-corporate businesses? How much of it is elimination reducing the alternative minimum tax, the tax rates and levels and brackets, et cetera, et cetera? You know, if you look at it, you can document that.
So, Jack, where does this all end? I mean, is this sustainable, this current system?
Well, you know, it's like, you know, use a metaphor, it's like a frog in a pot of water, right? You turn it up, the heat up slowly, the frog doesn't jump out, right?
Right.
Until it boils. You turn it up too fast, you know, the frog will jump. Well,
right.
They've been turning it up for us ever since Ronald Reagan, little by little. Right? So far, they've been getting away with it, right?
Mm.
They destroyed the union, so we don't get any wage increases, but, you know, they get us cheap goods from Walmart, so, you know, we don't have to get the wage increases. Or they give us more and more debt as a way of, instead of a wage increase, they let us take on more debt, you know? They let us take on $1.5 trillion student debt, $1 trillion-plus credit card debt, $1 trillion-plus now auto debt, the mortgage debt and so forth, right? We're loaded up on almost $14 trillion in debt. Well, that's been allowed in place of decent wage increases, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they take away the good jobs, they send them offshore, and they give us, you know, the Uber jobs, stuff like that, part-time jobs, people working 2-3 part-time jobs, right? Or they, if we can't afford medical care, they give us Obamacare, where part of the money is subsidized for the poor, largely you know, through various means here to find $900 billion for Obamacare, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here. So they have ways of keeping the lid on through debt and through, you know, other second, third jobs and all these other means. And so far, it seems to have worked.
Yeah, and if you're working three jobs, you don't have time to protest. So
that's right.
Yeah. In the subtitle of your book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Rope, it says monetary policy and the coming depression. Are we facing a depression?
Oh, I think it's inevitable. The next recession may not be it yet, but it's inevitable because if you look at the trajectory of financial instability and crashes since the 1980s, when all this really begins, you know, the big free money from the central banks pumping up the financial speculation and financial globalization and the bubbles and so forth. And the bubbles keep popping up in different places in the world and different markets. But the bubbles appear to be coming more and more synchronized and ever larger. And what I'm saying is that we're going to eventually have a global financial crash that will make the last one in 2008-09 pale in comparison. And their measures, their tools, central bank tools, right, monetary policy tools and fiscal policy tools, may prove ineffective. They're becoming increasingly ineffective as they're used to subsidize capital incomes and rather than stabilize the system anymore. They're becoming increasingly ineffective. At the same time, the financial instability and bubbles are getting larger and more synchronized. That's why I say at some point you're going to have a financial crash and the traditional means for trying to resolve the crisis will not work.
So it will be pretty deep and ugly.
It'll be too deep, and the fiscal monetary measures and tools, traditional tools, will not prove ineffective,
right.
Ineffective in trying to reverse and engineer a recovery. There's like two trends you can see in the last 30, 40 years, you know, the bubbles and the free money and the income inequality, which is a symptom. Not a cause, a symptom of it. You can see that getting worse and bigger at the same time the solutions, the policies are getting less and less effective. At the same time, income inequality is growing. So that's pretty much why I say there's going to be another depression at some point, although I'm not prepared to say the recession that's coming could come by the end of this year, 2019. It could happen. May not be the big one. You know, it's coming. It's inevitable. There's going to be a recession. It may not yet be the big one, but I really believe sometime in the next decade.
Big one is coming. Yeah.
Yes, it will happen.
Yeah. And now what can people do, if anything, to protect ourselves from this or shield the damages? Or
well, you know, protect yourself is pretty difficult because the only way you can, as an individual, protect yourself is to amass a kind of cash buffer.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, people are having a hard time of doing just that, working two and three jobs with no wage increase. You know, average working folks have no way of individually doing it.
Barely make ends meet, so they're never going to get a buffer.
Right.
Yeah, right.
You know, and as you say, if you're working two or three jobs, you don't have time for politics. So it doesn't look good for individual solutions. I believe the only solution really is to have a truly independent politics, independent of the two wings of the corporate party of America. Admitting that, you know, there's some good people on the left, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, who are trying to reform and change it. I don't think they can. I think the money bags have a stranglehold on that party, and it's not going to change. And you see the Republican Party being, before our very eyes, reformed in Trump's image. It's his party now, right? And, you know, the Republicans will continue going to the right, and the Democrats will continue remaining at center-right and will not allow a reform to occur. And I think at some point the progressives and the Democratic Party are going to have to realize there must be a new political party and a new formation. And the only solution is to compete for the institutions of power and institutions of government, the Congresses and the state houses and so forth. That's the only solution. It looks relatively bleak right now and will continue, I believe so, as long as people function under the fiction that they can change the Democratic Party. This is not the party of our grandparents. This is not the party of FDR anymore. This is not even the party of my youth in the 70s. No, this is a different animal that under Bill Clinton transformed itself into a a corporate party dominant wing, you know, Democratic Leadership Conference took over that party, and it's been dominant by the money bags ever since. You're not going to change that party. There has to be an independent political formation, and I think after, you know, we see once again that Sanders gets dumped on, even though the majority may want him in, of the actual voters in that party, you know, people will have to wake up to the fact that there has
it's not going to happen through our two main political parties, right? The change we need.
No, I don't. Yeah. I don't believe it can. Yeah. I don't have the formula for, you know, how you create an independent political party, a progressive party.
There are some counterweight
to the Trump, the Trumpists. You know, a true counterweight to that on the left. Certainly, a majority of people out there, I believe, in America, want that. A majority want that, you know. I mean, you look at the polls, and the majority wants Medicare for all. The majority wants better Social Security. They want better jobs. They want free public education. You know, Sanders' program and some of the others, you know, and the progressive wing of Democrats have a pretty good program. Problem is, it will never be adopted by the Democratic Party in an election.
Right, because as we said earlier, the corporate world of the 1% are controlling all the levers of power, and so this can't happen.
Including the political parties, you see.
Right. I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, they've deepened their control of the institutions and taken over the institutions, mm-hmm. and now including the institutions of the political parties, and somehow there has to be a movement of folks who won't accept that and will challenge that. Both at the political party level and at the institution level, you know, Congress and the state houses and so forth. I think that majority is out there, but it's not organized.
No.
It's not organized.
Right.
You know, as I say when people ask me this question that you have or something similar, I say the crux of the problem today is the organizational question.
Right, and they have ways now of disrupting people from organizing well, too, through infiltration, et cetera.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah. Jack, I have one last question for you because we're almost out of time. How does war play into all of this? We've been in perpetual war now since 9/11. Does that play into this at all, the whole financial thing, the wars?
Well, war allows and justifies. I remember back in 2001 and so forth, the neocons who gave us that war, and now they're back in the driver's seat under Trump. You know, the Boltons, the Millers, and so forth, Abrams, the same people who gave us Iraq are right there now. And I remember them saying, this is going to be a war on terror forever, never ending. What they really want here is, you know, the war has enabled them to really chip away and restrict and limit the civil liberties and democratic rights, and they're still continuing to chip away at that.
Yeah.
So, and, of course, that makes it more difficult to take back the democracy, to take back the country. You know, makes it more difficult, isn't it?
Right.
So, that's war has that consequence, that political, ideological consequence. War also has the consequence of more and more of our taxpayer money and so forth is going to the war machine, not just the Pentagon with its $700 billion budget, but when you look at the fact that all these other military arms now, NSA and CIA and so forth, and all the other expenses, you know, we're spending about $1 trillion a year on, quote, defense, homeland security, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And certain small number of big corporations are benefiting largely from that defense thing. So the war is a way of subsidizing certain corporations.
Right.
A certain wing of U.S. corporate elite, and we have an economic empire. The U.S. has an economic empire, and that's what the trade fight is all about, in part, you know,
mm-hmm.
to make sure that empire, the U.S. share of slowing global trade, is maintained. They're rewriting the rules of the trade game here that Trump is doing, with the full support of the capitalist class in this country, by the way. You know, that's all part of this. The U.S. has forces in, has 800 bases in 143 countries we're in. We have 800 military bases. Don't tell me this isn't an empire. Of course it is.
It is, yeah.
All the monetary system, the banking system, the IMF and everything, we control all of this.
Right.
The currency of the U.S. is the global empire currency. It's an economic and political empire and military empire. It just doesn't look the same as 19th century British. It's got a different structure to it, but it's there nonetheless.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time, which is unfortunate because you have such a wealth of knowledge, and I feel like I learn so much when I listen to you. So maybe we could do this again in a couple months.
And again, you were just listening to the second and final part of an interview with economist and author Jack Rasmus. To learn more about him, his website is jackrasmus.com. And again, Rasmus is R-A-S-M-U-S. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.